curse. The show we were just in, you know, this Tas du Sacre, there's three black identical paintings on the wall, and they're all made out of dead flies.
Yeah, and did he have something to do with that?
It's his.
It's historical work.
And it's his only major work that hasn't been sold.
Is it an old work done a long time ago?
No, it's a fairly new work. I think two and a half years ago.
And the old
for the show.
And it's made out of actual flies.
Yes.
Okay. The article came out. Millions
of dead flies.
How did he get them?
He doesn't do any of his own work.
Oh, it's like Warhol.
Everything is done for him.
He just orders up the idea and then it's done. This article...
I'm sure he pays for it.
Right. September 17th, it says, London. While Wall Street was crumbling on Tuesday, an auction house in central London was seeing Damien Hirst, the richest and now one of the most financially savvy artists in British history, saw him smash records in a sale that raked in nearly $200 million. The two-day sale of 223 pieces of Hirst's artwork made a spectacular $199 million, beating expectations for $175 million, Sotheby's auction house told Forbes. It also exceeded the $116 million target Hirst had reportedly set for himself. The artwork sold included a shark in formaldehyde and a 1,320-pound bull in formaldehyde whose hooves and horns were cast in solid 18-karat gold. It was named the Golden Calf. Well, that's sort of symbolic of Wall Street. You know, it resonates with it. So the so I'm just trying to say that that art, if you didn't have the art, the museums and the art, the industry.
Well, it's very, very interesting. I mean, here he has this. We've shown, like, the Shiva painting from the Tabernacle. I've got four of the Tabernacle paintings left. It was shown in the four places during Summer of Love, and now in Tras du Sacre, I've offered it out of $50,000, and nobody but buys it.
Well, that's how ancient you are, how irrelevant you are in a certain way.
Irrelevant, right?
Yeah, but
irrelevant, but needed to establish some kind of historic picture.
Exactly, and that's what I was just going to go into, how I've talked to Michael Snow about this and made fun of Peggy Gale. You know Michael Snow, you've heard of him, you know, great,
sure.
Canadian artist.
I know him.
Right, so I was talking to him a few years ago in New York City. I went to a show of his.
An artist and musician.
Yeah. And, he's probably the greatest Canadian artist of the last 20, 30 years.
He's a wonderful artist. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was talking to him. I said...
We were in a show together, the X-Screen.
When was that?
In Vienna, about 4 years ago.
Right. Another retrospective?
Yeah, X-Screen, it was, you know, pieces of cinema.
Right. So, I was talking to him, and I said, you know, you're not as important as the university professors in the culture game. I said, starting in the 70s, you have all these baby boomers and people older who need jobs, and they need to have content in the art, fine arts curriculum to talk about, so they can justify their jobs. So they bring in people like you, I said to Michael Snow, and then every other artist that ever happened, into meet the students and discuss what they did. It's all a replay of the history for the benefit of the universities who were booming in the 70s and 80s, you know. Well, they might have a crisis a bit, but they were the... McLuhan said the university was the new city. So I said to Michael, the first person who for me was the symbolism of this in Canadian history, art history, the first person going around, starting to archive and review what had happened in the 50s and 60s, was a woman named Peggy Gale. And I saw her at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in the early 70s. And he smiles because it's his wife, Peggy Gale, all right? I don't know if you know, Peggy Gale is Michael Snow's wife. And so I'm talking about, I'm just pretending I don't know that Michael Snow is married to Peggy Gale, though I did know it. And I said, so Peggy Gale was the first to do this, and she started it all up, started the Canadian history, art history curriculum. And he goes, yes. And he says, I'm married to her. And I said, yeah, I know. And so we laugh about that. But I said, you're just a prop now. And that very theme I'm saying about Michael Snow is what you're recognizing about yourself. You're a prop for the universities, for the museums.
The museums. Yeah.
Yeah, which is very tied in with universities. I mean, people go to, like this Shoki person I'm talking about, she's offered a job, at a school in Scotland. She's wondering whether to take it. She has to compete for it, but it's a big, high-paying job, yet she has to wonder whether maybe I should stay in the art world or the avant-garde, where that's more important. Like, do you go into becoming an archivist, so to speak, or do you continue making new work? Now, you're making new work with your opera, right?
Yeah.
You know, and yet you have to juggle the fact you're a prop, and you give meaning to the courses at universities or in museums. Yeah, you don't make any money, and there's a whole other world of that Damien Hirsch is in, where he's going to be in that history, but he doesn't have to go around being propped up by it, because he's cashing in on the present.
That's right.
Okay, so we're kind of, I'm trying to do this story of your life with this in mind, you know what I mean? We're recognizing, I'm not a university, I'm not trying to fit you into a thing. I want to show you the living. I don't know if people, when they present you, they're looking at the artifacts. They're not going into your history. They don't know that you worked with Ginsberg and everybody else you ever heard of, or worked in the computer world, right?
Well, maybe they don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. That's not, that part of your life is not relevant to their mission, preserving what you, ESCO, did. So that's the page on the program and then the review. There's a picture in the next page of a church or something. It says Just Us. J-U-S.
Yeah, that's the church we still own.
That's Garnerville.
Yes.
And in the picture, I recognize, I'm pretty sure I see Stuart Brand on the right.
Yes, you do.
Was he a member of the commune or just dropped in a lot?
No, he was part of us.
But not ESCO?
Yeah, he was part of ESCO.
What was his role in ESCO?
He was a photographer, and he learned a lot about multimedia from us, and he used it in his first big media work, which was called America Needs Indians.
And where did he do that? Where is that presented?
In various places, I think mostly in California, but he was married, to an American Indian.
I wonder if that's the woman beside her in the picture, the one with
it is him.
With the glasses.
It is. Yes, that's her.
Yeah, yeah. So that's before he starts Whole Earth Catalog in 69.
Yes, well, she did most of the work on that.
Ah, okay. She was a graphic designer?
He later abandoned her after he got wealthy. And
that's the dark side of the history that you know about, right?
Yeah, I still know Lois. She remarried and has now a grown daughter who's an artist, and, she's fine.
How did he meet her? In what context? Looking for masculine?
somewhere in California. He had a bunch of friends, and she was part of the group. I can't think of the couple.
Right, but in his first art show, he's celebrating his relationship with her. I mean, saying, "We need Indians." What was the title of the show?
America Needs Indians, yes.
And so he's influenced, it's really about her and his relationship with her.
Yeah, well, his whole first years of efforts had to do with the Indians and peyote. And
he was taking the peyote. And
yes, he practiced as what's called a road man, the guy who guides the trip.
Okay, like the shaman.
He actually had a teepee, which he bought and which he used to set up.
And he would guide trips?
Yes.
So was he doing it better than Baba Ram Dass or Richard Alpert in terms of the way Alpert chaotically distributed LSD and probably didn't guide people through it, right?
Stewart had his own chaotic impulses.
Right. So the thing is, though, that I'm just thinking that Stewart, in a way, follows the same path as you. He does get involved in technology. He's there at... The guy who created the mouse, Doug, what's the famous guy, in Stanford land, you know, the Doug Engelbrecht or something. You know, he invented, he put on a show in 1968, historically in the computer world, the famous show where he presented the mouse, and Stewart had something to do with that. He helped Engelbert. Do you know what I mean, Engelbrecht?
Yeah, no, I can't remember his name, but I know who you mean, and that whole group around there is what the Fred Turner wrote his book about.
Yes, yeah.
And also John Markov.
Yes, he did a book too. And I'll just put in here, Markov and Fred, they would have and did interview Mark Stallman, and then Stallman would give him a different take on what was going on, and I don't know if they're quoted, if he's quoting the books, but they all pass through Mark and hear his view of the whole history of that.
I don't know, but if you say so, I guess.
No, it's true. I mean, Mark would tell me that Fred Turner came by, and Markov has always been talking to Mark, because he knew of Mark when he was on Wall Street and did the made AOL public, you know, he directed the IPO of that, but and Mark is not very suspicious of Stewart Brand as military intelligence, fostering, you know, these fads, and that Stewart Brand is the one who said, well, we can't get America turned on by drugs, let's psychedelicize them through computers, and that's what Mark objects to as a computer expert himself. And you would be lumped in as a dupe of Stewart Brand, you know. But he goes on.
Stewart and I are not friends.
Right. Personally, you're not a dupe of any of these guys that McLuhan would.
Well, I don't know about any of them, but Stewart and I have had monumental differences.
Right, and you have with Richard Alpert, a lot of the key people who hoik up the what's called the Aquarian conspiracy angle, you're not involved with them, you're not impressed with them, you're not fooled by them.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, and so I think if Mark listened to this interview, he'd be interested. As a matter of fact, I do remember when he met you and we talked about it, about you through that period, 2000, 2001, 2002, he said, you know, Gerd is the only one who remained human or not a megalomaniac or someone that I would object to. I mean, Mark approved that you survived the whole corruption that he saw in that world.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
What are we on to now?
Okay, I'm just trying to find Engelbart, the approximate...
I forgot about it.
Douglas Engelbart, that's who it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so looking at this... The church, it's inside, there's a huge church inside where you guys put on performances and that?
Well, it was mostly our studio, and eventually it housed the tabernacle.
Okay, right.
And we opened it to the public on weekends.
I see in the picture, I can see a person, beginning of an afro but very tiny with glasses, that would be you right in the middle of the picture.
Yep.
And then Steve Durkee is either on the right or left of you. I think it's two young handsome guys, you know, I don't know which one's which, but you know, Stewart goes on to create, he popularizes the MIT lab, he writes a successful book, and you know, it's the reading that book that Don Thiel got the idea. When Stewart says, or quotes scientists of MIT saying they look into people like McLuhan and that and use them for ideas, in developing how to do the cognitive domains they're trying to technologize. That inspired Don, just because they said McLuhan. He says, that's Finnegan's Wake. And so he goes back and looks at Finnegan's Wake as a precursor and miming of digital, the coming digital culture. And so he was inspired by the MIT book with Stuart Brand. And then Stuart Brand goes on and is part of the Wired revolution, the Wired magazine world, right? And it's in the first issue of Wired that Stuart Brand interviews Camille Paglia and says, you're the first person to come along to remind me of McLuhan. So McLuhan is a big thing in Stuart's mind, like it is for you. I don't know if it was early, but it became a big aspect.
No, he learned about McLuhan from us.
Right, from the
from USCO.
The what?
During USCO.
Yeah, that you would talk about McLuhan. You didn't have to talk about John Cage and the report anymore, getting it for John Cage, because McLuhan now was a figure, so you would just talk, make them aware of McLuhan. Though you would be talking about McLuhan in 64, 65, before McLuhan became a household name in 67. You know what I mean? You were ahead of that, ahead of the McLuhan awareness.
Well, unfortunately, somewhat responsible for it.
Yes, I forgot about it, yes. Okay, looking at the, in the booklet here, what is the love to come to a real destruction?
Well, that was at the time when, well, first of all, I was trying to test one of McLuhan's ideas about how a very small input could cause a large reaction, right?
Now, this is after the Kennedy assassinations, Friday, December 27th. I'm assuming it's that 63 period in San Francisco, right?
Right.
Okay.
And second of all, the U.S. and Russia were discussing destroying weapons, you know.
Was that the beginning of the SALT talks?
I guess, but you remember that they were only going to have a certain amount of missiles or a certain amount of airplanes, potential, you know.
Right, this may have been one of the reasons why, if the military was involved in planning the assassination of Kennedy, that's why he was assassinated, because he was talking this way with Khrushchev.
So we invited these people to come and bring things which, you know, were sentimental objects which they were ready for some reason to destroy, and we had a destruction team on stage, and you know, it was we rented a little old theater in right in the middle of kind of Chinatown in San Francisco. And we filled the theater with an audience, but what the real interesting thing was we had all the television networks there, because, you know, we had kind of billed this as something to do with that movement about destroying, you know, armaments, and we got a tremendous amount of exposure for very little input.
You said that you had television works there? What's that mean?
We had all the television networks.
Oh, they came to see it.
Yeah, and the newspapers, you know, it was a big press event, and it created a big tumult with very little input. We had these crews on stage with sledgehammers and other kinds of things to destroy things, and like...
That's all you provided? The place and the sledgehammers, and then everybody brought the stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, other tools too, shears and hydraulic jack and things, and it was a very interesting.
But this would be more like a happening.
This was a happening.
Okay, it's a happening. It's,
but I mean, I don't know that we used that word, but it's performance art.
Right, performance art. You know, I go back to the title, Who Are You? What's Happening? People might have thought it was a happening, but it's you create a new kind of happening. And it's happening.
I think at that time the word happening wasn't even a big word yet.
People didn't know about it when it was happening in New York. It didn't become culturally known yet in the history books. I know there was a book on happenings that McLuhan quotes in Cliched Archetype, which comes out about 1966. So that might have been the first book on it, the first recognition of it. But okay, so you're part of the happening world. Are you in touch with Caprao and those people? You're aware of what?
Yeah, I knew Alan and I knew Klaus Oldenburg, and yeah, I knew all those people.
But see, you created this. Who are you? You know, who are you? What's happening? Which was Stravinsky and amazing thing in light of Finnegan's Wake and Feedback. I'm suggesting you didn't fully realize what you had done, and you still.
Of course I didn't. You know, you never do.
Yeah, and you thought it was happening.
We were just trying to make some money to fund Contact initially.
Yes, yeah. But the thing is that you thought of it as a happening, maybe, and then you went on and made another happening, which is this love to come to a real destruction.
Right. I mean, well, hey, you know, after you have a successful
happening
thing like that, but it was a whole different idea.
Yeah, the brochure says, here's what you handed out, I guess. It says, you've got much more than you want, much more than you need. It's hard to give away what you need, harder to give up what you want. Time moves fast, in brackets, haste makes waste. There's not enough time, E-N-U-F, for enough. There's not enough time to use up what you've got, not enough time to love what you keep. Opportunity knocks, dump a piece of your load, bring valuables. It's almost like a hippie thing. You know,
it worked. It was the other thing that I was thinking of was the potlatch.
You mean yes, as a cultural reference point? The old traditional Americans needs Indians. Well, we need their potlatch. What you're saying.
Right.
And then on the second side of the brochure it says, "Bring something you've got, anything you need, nothing you don't want." Bring it to the Bella Union Theater, 825 Kern Street, 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. It's a long show.
Yeah.
The decision of the judges is final. If your possession is accepted for destruction, it will be destroyed before your very eyes. Now, you did that, right?
Yes, we did.
Only inanimate objects, objects which can be carried by one person. No concrete blocks, boulders, intangibles, libraries, or garbage. Welcome. None of that is welcome. Gerd Stern. Then below, judges will refund total or partial price of admission as a prize for objects highly valued for destruction. So that's just in here. Is there anything you want to say about that show?
It was a great success. I mean, we got tremendous coverage for the concept and with very little input, and it was a lot of fun. On top of it, we had these really big guys. One of them, a black drummer who I knew, and they had all these big tools, and they did a wonderful job of destroying things. And, you know, there were a couple of kids that brought toys, and there were adults that brought various, you know, sentimental possessions, and, you know, radio, and all kinds of wild stuff, clothing, lingerie, food items. So
it was shown on the local television news.
Oh yeah, national television.
Oh really? So what was the reason it was significant? What did they think they had? Why did they want to broadcast that? What did they think was happening?
Well, we publicized it ahead of time, and we mentioned the fact that we were it also had to do with the destructive idea of that we could destroy weapons on both sides. And
that you pointed it out, that you're making, you're miming,
yes,
what the political mood was.
Right.
You know, you can see in your 50s life as a press agent and all that stuff really prepared you for these things. You knew how to make contacts with the media.
I knew the people in the press, and and I knew, and even when I didn't know them, I knew how to approach them. Yes.
Yeah, you were preparing for your role as an artist, at this kind of media artist in the 60s.
And of course, Herb helped.
Yeah. So you you know, you had connections. So the 50s life prepared for the 60s thing, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, the effects precede the causes. Now, there is a review of Contact High. Okay, it's by Theodore Brett, and it says, has a picture of a woman on a highway with a stop sign on her shirt, and a picture of you with no stopping, different. And then this says at left, Stern works on Contact is the Only Love, and at right, a model models a sweatshirt and very little else while Stern poses with an auto tire. Okay, so that's the pictures in this review. And
yep.
It's in a magazine called Bonanza, December 8th, 1968.
Part of the San Francisco newspaper. Yeah.
Right, right, the supplement. San Francisco Sunday Chronicle, December 8th, 63. So this is, the other one was November 13th. So you get another article, you know, almost a month later. And it's called Art Goes Faster and Faster.
Right.
And that actually is what happened. In the 60s unfolded, everybody was doing something, and then it would move on to some other movement. You know, just really, the art world, you just had to come up with something better and one up the next guy. And McLuhan had that quote in Medium is a Massage, art is anything you can get away with. So you actually are starting the thing of media events and each new scene, and you would get obsolete within 6 months. Someone else would be doing something. Warhol would come in. Warhol, I mean, I think it's about early 64 he starts being noticed, really getting noticed. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, the... okay, I know Marilyn Monroe died in 62 in August, and that was when he closed his show in L.A., and then he made a big art silkscreen thing on Marilyn Monroe, and that really took him off. So maybe he was starting to show up in late 62, early 63. And then by the time you're doing this, I think he starts to get into film.
Right.
Taping, you know.
Yeah, by the time I got back to New York, he was into film.
Right, and he was hot, right? He was what everybody was talking about? Yeah.
Well, I don't know about everybody, but the thing about Andy was that he was a social butterfly, so he managed to be very much on the scene.
Much like you, like he was a big, the most successful magazine illustrator by 1960, and he knew the whole gay scene and the important people in that world. So he had social contacts. See, that's sort of something I thought of. He had made social contacts like you did. But he did want to get into the high society world, which he was ostracized from. What's his name? Who were the lovers? Jasper Johns and Claus?
No, but Jasper and Bob Rauschenberg.
Rauschenberg. And they would have nothing to do with whatever art he was trying to make in 61, 62. So he was trying to make it into the high society world, and he did it successfully with the Marilyn Monroe. And then he moved, and he became the center of the social world. But it's similar to what you were doing, and then you guys crossed paths at the Murray the K world, the world stuff, you know. So you actually are you are parallel to Warhol. He doesn't go digital. In the early 70s, he goes back into marketing his magazine interview and doing portraits. He does not move into new technology like you do. You know what I mean? In terms of your intermedia enterprise. But
that's
this, the review says, Gert Stern, the local poet, you're the local poet, is now fascinated with highway markers. Turn left, turn right, stop, yield. All the signs that seem so authoritative, so direct when viewed singly and personally, are dulled by the speed of the freeway driver until responded to almost subconsciously. Stern's latest efforts are directed toward the end of reestablishing the authoritativeness of evoking a conscious reaction on the part of the onlooker. This is his theme. Is Bonanza, is this like an art critic guy? Is this a sophisticate writing this?
Yeah, it's San Francisco, you know, people.
It's a journalist, art, a journalist critic kind of guy. And Bonanza is something everybody sees every weekend, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he goes, this is his theme. His creations in quotes, in this respect are varied. They are the sweatshirts imprinted with facsimile traffic signs. There is an experimental motion picture in which the camera analyzes the speed and the maze of directional signs on a freeway and contrapuntally examines a female nude, micrographically. That's Judith, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Then there is, for lack of a better expression, the controlled happening, in quotes, the controlled happening, which was presented at the San Francisco Museum of Art Auditorium last month. Oh, okay, so he brings up that. Entitled, Who Are You and What's Happening? This performance was an experiment utilizing tape recording, telephone, television, projected images, and a cast of 16 persons selected from all walks of life. It was presented as a poem in light and sound and explored the effects of simultaneous communication and media interaction. The result, according to Alfred Frankenstein in his Chronicle review of the opening, was a landmark of a flop. Added Mr. Frankenstein, the show laid so fast and horrendous an egg as to score a kind of success. So he's quoting Finkelstein. Then Theodore Brett says, a further exhibit of Mr. Stern's at the San Francisco Museum of Art includes a work called Contact is the Only Love, a large electronic sign with flashing lights. The sign emits 480 flashes per minute and says, among other things, stop, yield, and go, all to the accompaniment of a rather nerve-shattering grunching sound. Grunting in italics. Of course, if contact is the only love, in quotes, doesn't make it for him, Mr. Stern still has sweatshirts which are available in the racier marts. These could possibly do a great deal for him. Look what they've done for Beethoven. And I think he's referring to Beethoven sweatshirts or the Beatles song. Were there Beethoven sweatshirts at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Not the Beatles stuff. Okay. I think the Beatles' Roll Over Beethoven was happening around that time. I wonder if that might have sparked the sweatshirts, because the Beatles...
Well, our sweatshirts, there was this guy, this friend of mine who had seen some of the work I did, and it was his idea to print the sweatshirts. But we never made any real money on them.
This is photo by Pete Peters. He's not the one who came up with the sweatshirt idea.
No.
This is photo by Stuart Brand and another photo by Stuart Brand. So your rate, you could have become a big deal right then. You know what I mean?
Maybe.
You could have. You're right on the avant-garde. You're being reported on the newspapers. I mean, not many other. Well, I don't know. Were there other gallery scenes being reported on like this?
Who knows?
Right. But the article starts with a turn left, right, stop, yield. It doesn't give the title of all that. That's Contact is the Only Love until the end of the article. What's funny is that it talks about the content of the Contact show, which is this film, right? Or is it a film or slides?
Slides.
And is that happening automatically, the sides in the show for Contact? They're turned over automatically?
What are you talking about? Contact is the only love.
Yeah.
No, there's no slides or film. It's a
large electronic sign with flashing light. Oh, okay. So this
7 foot across, and you know, you've seen the little ones, haven't you?
Yeah.
Once.
So this is big thing. So he doesn't describe. He describes the meaning of the exhibit before he tells you what it is, but he goes through the happening thing first before he gets to what the first paragraph is talking about. It's a non-linear review. So you leave San Francisco right after that?
No, not right after that, because we go up to Vancouver.
Oh, then you meet McLuhan. Right? We've gone through that. The next thing is Hubbub at MIT, December 10th, 1965, in the Christian Science Monitor.
It's not. It's the next thing in the
book.
It's not the next thing that we did. Yes.
No, and just we've covered a lot of this in our previous hours, but just the review. What I find interesting is giving the dates. So this is. It says something called Hubbub, and this is in the Christian Science Monitor. Funny. Something called Hubbub, that's what they write, something called Hubbub was presented in the Kresge Auditorium at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology last night, employing an, quote, audiovisual collage technique. USCO, a group of some 20 experimenters, utilized an oscilloscope, rapid slide projector, movie projector, multi-channel speaker system, and assorted stage devices to create a show which strove for strange new effects. 6 episodes or movements comprised this media mix. Movements and media mix, in quotes. The first featured a bare-chested youth straddling a TV set, whose screen showed the waving lines of an oscilloscope. Slides and film clips of subliminal brevity were projected on the wall behind them, while gongs, siren-like wails, country music, and unidentifiable sounds were played over the speakers. Then it has flickering images as a subtitle. In the second section, the same fellow... Who is this person? Do you remember? Who is the person?
Yeah, it was just somebody who wanted to be part of the show, and we told him that the only thing we had that he could do was to sit in Zen posture, or, you know, meditation posture on top of the oscilloscope.
Oh, yeah. That's Gnome. I met Gnome. His name is Gnome. Gnome something. N-O-A-M. Yeah. He, Gnome. I think we mentioned this earlier in the tape. Yeah, Gnome. So he, it's confused me. He's straddling a TV set, but you have him sitting up there. Yeah. You thought he was supposed to be sitting and meditating, right?
He was. He wasn't straddling it. He was sitting on top of it.
The TV set. So
with his, you know, with his legs crossed.
Right, in yoga, meditating position.
Right.
It says, in the second section, the same fellow painted cryptically religious messages on a backdrop, while lights and partially distinguishable images flickered around him. Did you tell him to do that, or he just improvised that?
No, that was something that we had originally done with Carolee Schneeman at the Filmmaker Cinematheque.
So you had him repeat that part?
Yeah.
Most of the remaining episodes reflected this pattern, quote, or colon, here's the pattern. Flashing slide or movie frames, dazzling light effects, blaring, undecipherable electronic sounds, and other unfamiliar impressions. While arresting at times, the presentation often seemed peculiarly repetitious and tedious. Ideas with an initial impact often became self-defeating through interminable extension, even though a cumulative effect was being sought. Now, I would say that's actually what was happening in the world under TV conditions, and what McLuhan thought was like Finnegan's Wake. An idea would pop up and disappear. A show would happen, and then it was canceled by the commercial or the next show. So you're describing the actual world of TV in the 50s. But nobody relates it sociologically. They say, well, this is a little show. Ideas with an initial impact often became self-defeating through interminable extension, even though a cumulative effect was being sought. And preoccupation with gimmickry tended to distort or destroy whatever was being communicated. Now just think of it. They came up with new effects on TV shows every season. And nobody saw that that's what you were miming.
Right. Well,
and you didn't see it, maybe. I don't know.
Well, the other way around, we were trying out new things, which later on were absorbed by the television industry.
Right. And then he says, the ends review, but the whole concept is a relatively new one. Through refinement, it may eventually evolve into accepted means of artistic expression. Little did he realize that art was anything you get away with, that it would be obsolesced by all kinds of other, well, by... rock concerts, LSD, you know what I mean? Psychedelic music, the Ken Kesey scene. Well, Ken Kesey had happened the year before, but lots of things would obsolesce this.
They were parallel phenomena.
Yeah, parallel, all within, McLuhan would say, the satellite effect. It was, you're miming the way media were as content in the hidden satellite environment. Were you trying to become an accepted means of artistic expression?
No.
No? You were just doing what you do, and you didn't know what you'd be doing next year, right? So the critic wants to pretend that, oh, this is a socially redeeming effort. They will become an accepted means. It actually, you know, our interview with Dave Werster and his involvement with LSD, the person he worked with, Robert Carr, he was doing the Retina Circus up in Seattle, and they did the first multimedia thing on television in the late 60s and won a Grammy for it. I don't know if you ever heard of that phenomenon.
No.
But that was sort of making it accepted, but it wasn't. It's not making it accepted as a gallery thing. It went into television and became accepted as an effect within the real art form, which was television. Yeah, so he calls it hubbub. No, you guys called it hubbub.
Yep.
Right. And it was at that show that Harold, what's his name, the famous strobe inventor, Edgerson?
Edgerton.
Yeah, he comes to this show. So yeah. There is, and he teaches you a lot, and then you move into 66, and that leads to Riverside, which is the next thing to be reviewed. There is a review here of the Cinematheque situation, and that seems to be January 18th. It's after the Kresge show. Does that make sense, or would this be January?
Well, there were two. One was before and one was after, I think. They were maybe a year apart. There was a Cinematheque across from Cooper Union, and then there was the Cinematheque up on 42nd Street.
Yeah, the address is 125 West 41st Street.
That's not the first
place.
That's the second one.
That's the second one.
That was not the festival. The festival was the first one.
And the festival, which would be in early 65, that was when you met John Brockman? He came in to help with that? Was that we were talking?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So a year later, does John Brockman have anything to do with the second Osco show?
I think by that time Jonas was back.
Jonas Mekas, right.
Yes.
So here's what, I don't know if this is a review or just a press release. It says, during the last few months, we have heard much about expanded cinema, expanded in quotes, the term used by Jonas Mekas for the expanded cinema survey at the Cinematheque last November. So that's what we're talking about, right? You performed at the expanded cinema survey.
Yeah.
In, well, he's saying last November. Does that mean November 65, a few weeks before the MIT, the Kresge?
Yes.
So it wasn't a year before.
What?
See, he's saying the expanded cinema survey.
Yes.
Last November. Do they mean November 65 or November 64, a whole year before? Because this is being written up in January 66.
Well, it wasn't just a couple of months. It must have been a year.
Right. Sometimes when you use the phrase last, you mean the previous year. You know, people... So, okay, this is after Kresge, so this is January 66. It says...
The other thing was before Kresge.
The first
yeah.
thing is before, but I think this is...
after, yes.
Yeah, this is after Kresge, so it's January 66. Which is going to be a good year for you in terms of USCO getting publicity. So it says, the last few months we've heard much about expanded cinema, and they mention the Jonas Mekas. Then they say, quote, psychedelic theater, in brackets the term used by Timothy Leary Group. So you had done Tim Leary in 65 in the middle of this.
At the New Theater, yes.
Yeah, and that would be before Kresge, according to this dating here.
Yeah, probably.
And then another term is media mix, in brackets the term used by USCO. Another term is combined-cinema, the term used by Stan Vanderbeek. So isn't that interesting, guys? Expanded cinema, psychedelic theater, media mix, and combined cinema. Then it says, the writings of Marshall McLuhan have provided a socio-philosophical basis for this new audiovisual movement in quotes. Artists such as Stan Vanderbeek, Angus MacLeese, Gerd Stern, Naim June Paik, Jerry Joffin, Robert Whitman, Barbara Rubin, Ed M. Schwiller have provided the practical examples of such works. Painters, dancers, and composers such as Robert Rauschenberg, Claus Oldenburg, Mercy Cunningham, John Cage, Elaine Summers, Lamont Young have used or contributed to such shows. Timothy Leary, the LSD scientist, employed it as part of the psychedelic theater last summer. So there's the date. See, we were trying to figure out the dates of these things. So the summer of 65 is when you did Tim Leary. And since last Christmas, when Stan Vanderbeek took half a dozen projectors into the Berliner Stadthaus for his feedback number one, Europe has been talking about it. Okay, so that definitely wasn't 2 weeks, 3 weeks before. You know what I mean? Wouldn't you say Stan Vanderbeek was like a year before?
A year before what?
Before this January's Cinematheque event on 42nd, 41st Street.
You mean the thing in the Berlin?
Yeah. Would that have been just a 2-3 weeks before?
Could have been.
Yeah, because he says last Christmas. See, the phrase last Christmas may mean the previous Christmas, not the one that just happened 3 weeks before.
Well, I mean, Vanderbeek wasn't part of the festival at the Jonas's thing.
Right.
Jonas had shown his films, but he wasn't part of Expanded Cinema.
But if he did this around Christmas, and it's 3 weeks later,
yeah.
The critic or the program, would they know that Europe has been talking about it so quickly? It would seem to take about a year to make the idea that Europe has been talking about it.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, it depends on who's writing this, I guess. They could have known immediately. So it says the filmmaker Cinematheque has been supporting these experiments since its inception. Last year, the Cinematheque held an extensive survey of the whole development with more than 30 artists participating. Now we feel that this work has reached proportions important enough for wider audiences to come and see what it's all about. So this is Jonas advertising this. We have singled out one program which we think is well suited to serve as an introduction to this new multiple cinema experience. For 1 week, beginning Tuesday, January 18th, every night at 8:30, the Filmmaker Cinematheque will present Hubbub, prepared and performed by the ESCO Group. Note on this specific program, Hubbub is a multi-channel media mix of films, tape, oscilloscope, stroboscope. That's after you've gotten Edgerton, or you already had a primitive stroboscope.
We had a primitive.
Yeah, okay.
But this was by this time.
You had a better one.
After Kresge, we've got better ones.
Kinetic and live images. Effects from one channel through a 12-channel mix is explored in six integrated movements, each hybridizing a set of media. These are titled cathode ray, and then one word all blurred, high free through Safeway, all put together, right? As one word. Y, ghost rev, diffraction film, and omic. So those are titles of your works. The artists involved in the program. ESCO is a group of people who work together, poets, filmmakers, engineers, composers, but they prefer to remain nameless. We are all one, says a ESCO spokesman. In a world of simultaneous operations, you do not have to be first to be on top. Why did you say that a couple hours ago? What was it about that? Who said that originally?
I did.
Oh, okay. In a world of simultaneous operations, you do not have to be first to be on top. And this is continuing the quote. The material is contributed by many people working individually or in groups all over the country and is assembled at our church in Garnerville, New York. As has always been the case with artisans in traditional societies, the work remains anonymous. So this was written by you.
Mm-hmm.
This is a press release.
Well, I don't know.
They put it together and used the quotes from you.
That wasn't the one by Archer Winston. Maybe it was, I don't know.
But this is January 66. You probably even had quotes like that at MIT. You probably, for press or for interviews. It says media mixes, capital letters, like that's the title of something, by ESCO have been performed at the San Francisco Museum of Art, University of British Columbia, Vancouver Arts Festival, University of Wisconsin, University of Rochester, Psychedelic Theater, MIT, and the Filmmakers Cinematheque. So, media mixes, what is that? Is that a particular part of this mixture of ghost rev, diffraction film, omics, and cathode ray?
No, I mean, you know.
Oh, I guess they just mean this whole performance. That's their,
yeah,
your
yeah,
term,
yeah,
right?
It means the whole performance, but it was a phrase that was used. Multimedia, media mix, intermediate.
That's what you used to explain what you were doing.
Yep.
Right. Now, there's a review, January 19th, 1966, New York Post, by Archer Winston.
That's the one I thought you were...
Right. Now, why did you bring him up before? What does he help
you? Because I remembered that he had written a review of that performance.
And we were trying to figure out the dates and whether last Christmas meant a year ago or not. But, okay. He says, it's titled Cinematheque's Hubbub. When it was all over, and Hubbub had been experienced quite loudly, Jonas Mecca, Cinematheque's high priest, apologized. Quote, the multi-channel media mix of films, tape, oscilloscope, stroboscope, kinetic, and live images had been deprived of its stroboscopic element due to the defection of certain electricians. Is that what happened?
I don't know.
This reviewer had not missed it, nor could he in conscience. This reviewer had not missed it, nor could he in conscience think that the full effect would have been better than 9/10 of it. So this is the genre of what's his name, Frankenstein? Yeah.
Yeah.
This is another Frankenstein attitude. The full effect would have been better if it was only 9/10 of it, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Meckes has suggested. Do you remember them apologizing?
No.
Mr. Meckes has suggested that this picture, aptly named Hubbub, showing each evening, blah, 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 in the basement theater through this Sunday, will serve well as an introduction to expanded cinema, in quotes, the avant-garde's latest audiovisual creation. So this is the phrase, like pop art. Now expanded cinema is the new term, right?
It was for a while, yes.
Yeah, I remember Gene Youngblood's book, Expanded Cinema. Let us therefore think about it for one moment of blessed silence. Let us therefore think about it for one moment of blessed silence. It is an extremely noisy picture. As many as 5 images simultaneously fill the screen. On either side of the screen, 2 small boxes reflect a repetitiously changing image of colored lights. In front of the screen, an oscilloscope seems to represent the sound, large, small, shrill, or loud, that you are hearing. The seated figure of a man who does nothing, says nothing, is near it. Meanwhile, do you know that I met Noam in like 95, 96 at a talk by somebody at City College, you know, downtown, maybe it was 68th Street.
I'm trying to think of his name.
Yeah, and it was down the 42nd Street University campus. And we got talking, and he told me about his role in this. And he told me to get in touch with John Brockman. And I called John Brockman. I'm pretty sure I called John Brockman, and I said, I'm a McLuhan archivist, wondering what you have to say about McLuhan, whatever. And he said, well, I think you should get in touch with Gerd Stern. And I never got in touch with you. He gave me your number. I don't know what happened. I didn't follow through, or if I did, I didn't get you. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that I met, heard you on Bob Fass, and that's how we met. But the interesting thing is that I had met the guy in this period, Noam, before I met you. And
I'm just trying to think of his name. He had a very Jewish name.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was a little off.
Yeah, yeah. He had studied Alan Watts, probably did a lot of drugs, and he was still being that way when I met him. He liked...
Yep.
Living low budget, you know, wandering around.
He had some money from his, I think his mother died.
Yeah, but he was going around and still sort of advertising the 60s sensibility. As a matter of fact, when he met me, we got talking, he said, I haven't met someone like you, or you remind me of the way we were back then, the way I was talking. You know,
he wanted desperately to be part of USCO, so, you know.
Right.
We let him be part of us.
I have his card, but it's back in New York with his name. Okay, it says, so we're talking about this person says nothing, does nothing. Meanwhile, the pictures, either still or live, continue on the screen, frequently flash so fast that the effect is subliminal, if any. See, if it may have no effect, he's saying. In one section of the movie devoted to road and traffic signs, a speeding camera and sounds... Okay, in one section of the movie devoted to road and traffic signs, a speeding camera and sounds of increasing ecstasy, and then in quotes, one way, icy, elevation 5,000, 2 lanes, clear road, summit. Those are the, I guess, signs, right?
Yep.
In that section, there were subliminal glimpses of the body, including a belly button, which was more highly defined. See, there it is again. The person is trying to see something that they can latch on to get meaning, right? And if they don't find anything, it's a flop. In another section, there was a heartbeat magnified to huge proportions. Reading this, does this bring back the whole environment to you, or is it long gone in your...
Yeah, well, no, yeah, I got it.
Right. Can you smell it? Smell the night, the
yeah,
environment?
Yeah, well, I'm not a good smeller, but...
But I mean in your imagination.
I can see it and hear it.
Yeah. Have you thought, does this evoke it? Or could you, if I didn't do this, would you have a strong memory? If I didn't read this, would you?
Well, no, I mean the reading certainly.
Enhances it. Do you think of that environment over the last 25 years? Do you think of that scene much? Did you think of it?
Well, whenever it comes up, I think of it.
Right, but yeah.
I don't think of it usually, you know, unless it comes up.
It ain't coming up much until lately. You weren't thinking of it.
Well, I mean, no, every few years somebody was writing a book or doing a, you know.
Yeah, and it would come up.
Or something. It would come up, yeah.
Okay, and then it says another. This section is called the cycle sound. In another section, the roar of motorcycles took over, and we careened along parallel roads, looking from behind the helmet of the two cyclists. That would be Judd Yalcott and who? Who are the cyclists?
Jonathan Ayers.
Jonathan Ayers, right. This roar was amplified until you felt it in your bones. It was at this point that Willard Van Dyke, the new movie curator at the Museum of Modern Art, after an hour of experiencing, departed, saying, in characteristic gentle understatement, enough is enough. So that's what Van Dyke, did you know him, Willard Van Dyke?
Sure.
So he, after an hour, he said, enough is enough. Almost immediately, the scene changed. Water was heard bubbling. Yes, it was water on the screen. Then sounds of a jungle took over, with all those discordant, piercing sounds one associated with Tarzan movie soundtracks. As climax, there was an enormous croak of a monstrous, unseen bullfrog. The
I
biggest...
doubt that.
What?
I doubt that, but go ahead.
You don't think there was that?
Well, it wasn't the bullfrog. It was some other sound.
Sound effect.
Okay. Yeah.
Was there an image of a bullfrog?
What? No.
As climax, there was an enormous croak of a monstrous, unseen bullfrog. The biggest and best I ever heard. You could almost see him swimming magnificently down the Hudson, the size and sound of a superliner. This was one of the few wholly satisfying moments of hubbub. I am not prepared to say that there cannot have been others. The motorcycle sound, for instance, was overwhelming. It has a blasting masculine aggressiveness that might someday be used for a worthy artistic purpose. See, might be useful someday. I suppose that the sounds of the female do have a message that can be grasped by most adults and some adolescents, though this is being used most effectively in a non-avant-garde storytelling film, in brackets, Repulsion. So that must have just come out at that time. What's his name did Repulsion? You know, he did Chinatown. He got caught with a 13-year-old. Yuzinski, funny, I forget these. We all know him, you know, the famous Polish filmmaker.
Yeah.
He did Repulsion, so that's Hepke. Probably... Who?
Roman Polanski.
Polanski, right.
Okay, peace
whose
next...
Whose girlfriend got murdered by Manson.
Yes. So the next final section says, peaceful Manhattan. If hubbub intends to underline the obliterating multiple impressions and pressures of modern life, okay, giving you something you'd as soon avoid, perhaps it makes a point. He's getting a little further than Frankenstein. My misgiving with this picture, as so many others of the group and movement, is that it has the torture effect of repetitiousness, carried on too long for comfort. This is not emphasis. It's Pavlov-inducing sleep in dogs. It's Pavlov-inducing sleep in dogs by means of boredom. The creators of this show may keep themselves awake by means of the machines, which have to be watched for malfunction, but those of us who simply come to watch will remain to doze or be irritated enough to go out into the suddenly peaceful, bucolic streets of Manhattan, where all is peace and quiet. You actually make Manhattan tolerable again.
Whatever.
So what do you make of that common reaction that it's boring, repetitious?
Well, they feel overloaded. And we eventually got out of that overload trip, and so that wasn't the kind of review that we got anymore.
So why did you drop it to make it more pleasant for people?
Well, I think as we told you that, you know, it was our reaction to what Edgerton saw, and we kept on seeing that audiences were, you know, and our spiritual awakening was indicating that we needed something, you know, more peacemaking and
right,
and you know, and we had experimented enough with that other emotion, so we shifted gears.
But you only had done it about four times.
We probably did it more like eight or nine times.
All these listings at the bottom right. It begins with
we did a lot, but you know, when we shifted. That's all, and it worked out well. But we, you know, it was all experimental. We weren't sure of anything, of why we were doing what we were doing. We had ideas, but you know, the actuality of a performance and the effect it has on the audience is something that you have to experience and ingest, and you know, and then you can kind of make changes. But you know, once you have, you're pretty well set with trays of slides and you know, sound tapes, in order to create a different impression, you have to remake the whole show.
Right. Now, in this booklet, you got a landmark of a flop and all about the who are you and what's happening. Then there's a picture of Mayor Baba, then the Just Us Church, then the hubbub, and then the hubbub at Kresge, and then the hubbub at January 66. It's the spiritual thing is the influence of Mayor Baba, right?
Well, partially, yes. And you know, of Steve's original Catholicism and Buddhist thinking and Zen and a Jewish Kabbalah spirituality and
LSD,
and acid, and you know, all kinds of influences.
Right. So here, we'll end today's session with this. This is a pamphlet or something you've made, April 6, 65. You're going to do something at Schwartz Hall, Brandeis University. Is that when you've met the guy, you know, the Brandeis Leary guy, the main guy who I talked about, you know, your friend, he's been, Paul is his name, you know, the professor.
Paul Lee. Well, Paul Lee sponsored us at MIT. Brandeis was earlier.
Yes, and did he sponsor you at Brandeis?
Yes.
Okay, so Paul Lee, this brochure, April 6, 65, you know, MIT is 8 months later. This is what's written. There's a picture of Mayor Baba and says, "We are all one, we are all one, we are all one," circled in a, you know, repeats in a circle. But below it says, "Yieldy, yieldy, 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 yieldy." Oh, I guess it's just yield, 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 but it'd be...
Yes.
Yield, 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 all lined up like a hundred-lettered thunder finning his wake. It's all joined. The word yield.
Yield.
Yes. Yield. Then you go, you're right, we are all one, on and off, in and out. A switch is thrown. Contact is the only love. Open up your hearts. Flashing along the through free cafe highway, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Ah, there's that. That was a song, pop song, can't you hear my heartbeat?
Yep.
Electrons dissipate energy in resistance. So do we surrender mastery through servitude. They are in the same place.
That's Mayor Baba.
Surrender mastery through servitude? That's it.
Yes.
They're in the same place. We are here now. Don't neglect your business. Advertise. For there is one light. Enlightens the world. Highest of the Most High. I love you, God. Or I love you, God. It's great turn. Or I love you, God is great. Okay. I love you, God is great. Turn on the Lutheran Layman's League, final solution to this age-old problem.
That's a collage, little collage thing I wrote.
Right, right of way, why not hold on? Once you have taken me into your heart, let go. It doesn't matter who's who's me, we, are us, like antimatter, which was a popular new term at that point, right, in physics, synchromesh, time shifting, phase one or phase I don't know if it's one or I, phase I, never let myself to out at the new Canaan barrier, Canaan, C-A-N-N, C-A-N-A-A-N, at the new Canaan, is that a place in the...
Yes, it's on the turnpike.
Okay, not, oh yeah, New Canaan, yes. That's in New York State or Connecticut. I've seen that anyways. At the New Canaan Barrier Rock is what's happening. Stop and flow. Ecstasis, spelled E-K.
Yeah.
Savage arms. We cross ourselves. Territories, fields, landscapes, disciplines down across to the Holy Ghost spring. We see the universal joint. Our own God image. Stay clear at all times. When container is off ground, keep America beautiful. We are all us at Swartz Hall. Brandeis University, April 1665. What's interesting, at the beginning, we're all one, on and off, in and out, a switch is thrown. You're putting electronic metaphors in there with pop culture radio content. This is exactly the collage that Joyce was doing in Finnegan's Wake. He would be writing down songs on the radio, mixed in with ideas.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, you're repeating.
But, you know, the parallel structures of thought and composition are legion.
Yeah.
I mean, one idea and one idea is two ideas is only one idea.
Yeah.
There is only one idea. We're all one idea.
Yes. Now, this is why McLuhan would be detached and claim he's a Victorian when he encountered you. Because he knew that Joyce had done this. Now, you're just young kids, and he knows that you're replaying a sensibility, and his message is for you to see a larger picture of why you're doing it, and that anybody who grew up in an electronic environment, if we turn off the electronic environment for 100 years, then turn it back on, people would do USCO. They would write like Finnegan's Wake. They would replay the sensibilities because the environment molds you to think that way.
I was listening today earlier in the car to a program that WBAI was repeating of a segment of Sagan's Cosmos program, you know.
The Billions and Billions guy.
Yeah, where he was talking about extra planetary civilization potential, you know.
Yeah.
And he was saying that with these billions of stars, and each of them has the potential of a planet, that would have to somewhere also bear the kind of life that we have and civilizations that may be way in advance of ours. And he was basically saying, you know, there's things happening at the same time all over the place.
Yeah.
And that one idea, it's that Unitarianism, which is so seductive, really, to us, that if we're into it, you know, and other people are completely not into it until we are all oneness. But it really grabbed us at the time, and that may have been the first time we used the phrase. I used the phrase "We're All One," but eventually it became the name of the show that we did.
Which show was that?
Well, the last period of USCO, after Hubbub, the name of the show was "We Are All One."
Was the title of Riverside?
No, we didn't do a multimedia show at Riverside. Riverside was an exhibition. But our multimedia show, our last bunch of them in various places, I think Brandeis, we were at Brandeis twice, and I think the second time it was We're All One.
Right. I turned the page in this catalog, and it has We Are All One, and circular, and it's turn, turn, turn. Then it says down by the riverside, opening Mother's Day. So you did use We're All One, the icon, or
yeah,
the circular, for advertising the riverside, but
yeah,
the riverside...
But we never did a multimedia show there because it was all exhibition.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the... okay, that was May 8th, June 19th, but that's... it's after midnight for you, so let's end with that. We'll pick up next time with Riverside and go through this booklet, and I want to get into what Richard Castellanos writes about you. There's lots of...
My God, you mean we're not finished with 21 hours?
No, no, because I'm trying to get into the idea level, like whatever.
Okay, well, I think this was more idea level this time than we've gotten before.
Yeah, we're just beginning on some level, and the thing is that... What's great is that you're doing things right now that you can talk about.
Okay.
Okay, so very good. Thanks a lot, Gerd.
Well, thank you, Scott. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I don't know what will become of all this, but I guess we're going to keep doing it.
just like what you did. You said that to us, go back in 65. I don't know what's going to become of all this, but we'll just keep doing it, right?
Well,
the same thing.
Thanks for all the photographs you sent.
Oh yeah, yeah. Some of the sunset. Did you see what I said?
Beautiful.
Yeah, 22 years on Wall Street, 85 to 2007 is the symbol of those sunsets.
Oh,
you know the title. We just had the supernova, you know, last year. So tomorrow we find out whether we get paid.
I see.
You know, on Wall Street.
Well, good luck.
Yeah. So we're all every man for himself now?
I don't know about that.
Depending on how the market responds to the bailout.
Well, we'll see what happens.
But the I like the reviewing this with the ideas, and the reviewers give good... They give an interesting statement that we can extrapolate on.
Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot, Garrett.
Thank you. Be well. Say hi to Carolyn.
I will. Okay, bye.